here we go with the inaugural edition of We Talk Comics with Mo.
We Talk Comics.
And Mo and my new co-host, I've upgraded folks from Addy, and that wouldn't be hard to do, obviously. Anybody who listens to us on We Talk Wrestling knows that we have some fun there. We're going to be talking with my partner, Brett, who I've known forever. Brett, how are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm not too bad, Mo. Let me tell you, I was actually wondering if I was going to be able to get a word in edgewise. I figured I would just have to try to mirror your conversation.
Well, you know, we do want people to listen, so we probably should be me talking most of the time.
Yeah. Right.
You're welcome.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're welcome.
And you think Addy's the problem, yeah.
Well, you can't deny he still is. Anyways, here we go, folks. We're going to be talking, like we say, comic books and another passion of mine. Brett, why don't you tell everybody, give everybody a little bit of background in what you have, your comic book history.
Well, my comic book history, I mean, really, I've been collecting for more years than I'd probably care to remember. I've read more series than I'd care to remember, especially considering the quality of the vast majority of them.
Dumped more money than you really want to remember.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And I think, and then after all the massive collection, we started up a store together and learned a lot about that, which, enough said in that regard.
That's in the past, but maybe in the future again. Who knows? You never know.
That's right. And, really been getting back into reading pretty heavily again. So I think it's definitely time to kick off this We Talk Comics. And tell us about yourself, Mo.
Well, basically, I'm, also, again, it's been reading since a little kid. I have a affinity for some of the smaller characters. Characters Power Man, Iron Fist, Blue Devil, Gru, things like that were always the things that I kind of gravitated towards for some reason.
Power Pack and the X-Babies. Yep.
There you go. There you go.
Characters.
Captain Carrot and the Zoo Crew. That type of stuff. I've always been a little bit into the smaller ones there. I did step away from it for a few years, but you managed to bring me back in. I'm glad you did. I think it's a great time to be reviewing and reading comic books because the quality of writing has improved drastically over the last, I'd say about 15 years, and the quality of the art over the last, I'd say 7 or 8 years has improved drastically as well. And just the techniques, the modern technology, the coloring and things like that are great. Also an exciting time with the digital comic books coming forward. I think that's an exciting thing from the industry. The industry hasn't really learned to kind of embrace yet properly, and hopefully they will. But I mean, because I think it's an exciting thing. Not that I know some people are always gonna want to have their books in a hard copy, but I think the digital comic books is an exciting way for the future. What do you think?
Well, I think that there's so many ways to look at it, and I think that a lot of what the companies are doing is very divergent. Marvel's really not. Too concerned about producing the newer or new comics that are only digital. I mean, they're producing a few, but it's not a ton.
No.
And then DC's not even producing those. I mean, I like what DC's doing to a certain degree with packaging codes to buy to get the digital comic when you buy the actual physical issue.
Yeah, but, that's a great idea.
But the problem that it is that it costs that extra dollar or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, so, that's the problem. You've already purchased it. Why should you have to spend the extra money?
Yeah.
But you know what? This is where I'm going. They're not really embracing the technology, or maybe they are embracing it and they're trying to feel it out and they don't understand it yet.
I don't think they want to. Really feel like they're perfectly happy staying in their closed box print mentality. But the number one thing, the number one thing that I don't understand about
them... Well, better the devil you know.
Well, yeah, but it seems crazy to me because you would think that if DC and Marvel were able to cut out the middleman of printing and just sell directly to the client without even having the stores involved, then they would be able to rake in the money even more so than... I say more so now than they do.
Well, you know what? You're right. Or just find a way to do it in partnership with stores would be a good idea. There's There is ways to do it that way. But yeah, I mean, you cut out the middleman, you're right. They would make more money. Number one, your distribution to every corner of the earth is easier and better. And number two, it's easier to build a fan base when they can immediately sample and try a product that they normally wouldn't. And you know what? You can theoretically charge less for them that way than you do with the print books. I mean, that's one of the things that's a problem, is that it's as much to download it as it is to get a hard copy.
Yeah, and that's flat out ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, especially since you can reach so many more. Your sales should, okay, you're going to charge less, but your sales will go up and you don't have a middleman. It just makes sense to me, right? But they're, yeah, I mean, like you say, they're afraid. They're afraid of things that are new, and that's, they got to realize that this is already out there. I mean, the fact is digital comic books are available and have been available for before they started distributing them in many, many ways. And, you know, embrace it. Well, this is part of what they need to do.
And as we start seeing newer technology for reading them, I mean, with iPads, with tablets, you know, even with smaller, like, iPod touch devices and that kind of thing, and on phones, the smartphones now, I mean, considering the different apps that are available for you to be able to read comic books on, I mean, that is so much easier for somebody to go on vacation or whatever than it is to actually
absolutely
carry six comic books. Because another thing is that
trade paper. I mean, they did eventually embrace trade paperbacks, but I mean, if I sit there and I go, you know what, I want an option of six trade paperbacks to read, and that's I'm putting that in my briefcase, or I can put it all on one tablet. Guess what I'm going to do?
A, you're gonna lose your shoulder because it's an extra 20 pounds.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing is it's and you know what, this is a thing for smaller publishers as well, because Marvel and comic books haven't had to embrace technology to the same degree as, say, films. Yeah, I mean, eventually they got better paper in, eventually they got computer coloring in and that type of thing. But as a general rule, the basic of what how you create a comic book today is not that different than it was 80 years ago. Whereas how you make a film today is incredibly different than it was 80 years ago. You know, even how you record a radio show is different than it was. The comic books have, this is so new to them because they haven't had to really embrace technology the same level as other entertainment mediums, you know? Maybe the only other one that doesn't really have to embrace technology so much is stage plays, but even they, if you look at what Broadway does and things like that, Spider-Man, disaster, I guess you could call it, but nevertheless, there's an attempt to embrace technology in a new way in that medium even that comic books haven't had to do.
Well, one thing that I would just like to add about you talking about films that I do find funny and ironic in a way is the fact that film has actually gone through another technology change up to a certain degree, where they've actually got newer technologies now that are still video technologies, but it actually records more like film. So you actually, instead of the less people needed to make video proper, you actually need more people to make this proper again, and it operates exactly like film on the post-production side. So it's almost like they're working hard, and they felt like they lost their way, so that now they're working hard to kind of bring it back.
Bring it back to what it is. But, I mean, it is capable nowadays in today's technology for people with $10,000 and a camera to make a film, whereas they couldn't do that in 15, 20 years
ago.
Well,
absolutely, so right. Yeah, I mean the biggest thing is the internet.
Yeah, absolutely, the internet. The internet.
And I mean, the internet speaks to everything. I mean, the internet, I mean, it's why we're here right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we hope you're enjoying it as well. Now, one of the things that's very interesting, we're talking about the embracing of technology. You and I were at the Calgary Comic Con recently, and we had
Comic Expo, yep.
Yeah, Calgary Comic Expo and Entertainment Expo. And we had a chance to conduct some interviews there. We're going to drop a couple of those into this episode a little bit later after we talk some more news. But
yeah, fantastic interviews.
Yeah, we have some great interviews coming up for you folks from there. And some folks we've managed to secure. One person we managed to talk to there, Canadian artist named Ken Stacey. We talked to him off camera. We didn't get this, but he offered an interview, and I hope he's still open to it down the road. And this, we talked to him about...
He's a really interesting guy. And yeah. And the thing that I like about Ken Stacey is I'd really like to be able to kind of be able to bring him on as a regular guest.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. But one of the things we talked to him about, technology and the way that as an artist and the distribution of his own product and the way that he was viewing this technology. And he seemed to me to be far more open than the major studios. And that's the thing, when we talk about these things, we talk about DC and Marvel, even the next biggest publishers, you know, they're afraid. Really, the people that need to be the ones to jump in and get in this and punch it down the throats and they're trying, but they're still trying to find their way as well, is those really small publishers. I mean, even they don't know. They're almost so used to waiting for the lead from the major publishers, like a DC and Marvel and Image Comics and these type of things, that they're still doing it there. Whereas, don't wait for the lead. Jump in and find your own way to use the internet.
Well, I think it still comes down to that concept, and I really truly believe that the small people have the most to gain from the internet and selling their product direct. I mean, it's the kind of thing that could theoretically, like the music industry, almost put the major companies out of business, because you could actually create your own universe, your own characters, and sell them directly to people without needing to publish, without needing to print. But I think the key thing is that people are still holding on to that print concept, and you don't need a physical issue to read a comic book now. No. And I think until more people get that through their heads, then, you know, because once people get that through their heads, then it's a revolution.
Well, that's the thing. And, you know, I mean, you see the music industry, obviously the sale of records has gone down drastically, and the amount of money that's being made from the actual production of music has gone down. I mean, touring is where now people are able to make the majority of their money now if you're a popular artist. But I do think that the smaller publishers have yet to find the proper way to use it. But even as it goes, it built up, and you know, there was the peak of CD sales, you know, where you have the popular artists selling 10, 20 million copies, and they were making incredible amounts of money in the, you know, early 90s and late 80s, the 80s. I mean, just the economy was great. They were making a bunch of money. So what
and
you had...
affording more drugs, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's the thing. But, and they were absolutely making, you know, a bunch, right? So what you had was, now you have a comeback down to the point where people are not... Well, they're finding other methods to find their music. They're the illegal methods or legal or whatever they're doing. They're finding other methods to find their music. And the industry, the music industry is being scared of this. Also, the same thing, the same idea as the comic book industry. They don't know how to embrace the technology. They're getting a little better. But ultimately, what you're going to see is everyone's like, oh, the music industry is dead. It's dead. It's not dead, folks. What it is, it's evolving. And the comic book industry will evolve as well. It has to, you know, because technology is changing. But, it's just stop being afraid. That's the thing. Stop being afraid and go, you know what, even if it's not today as good as it can be, work to make it better for the future, because it has great potential.
Well, I think what you have to realize now is that not only the small press people, especially, not only do you have to be a good writer, a good artist, but you have to be a better marketer.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, even us in something like this show, we need to find a way to market and get it out there in a smarter and a better way than someone who might be on Sirius XM and that type of thing, or you know, a big name person who's on a major podcast network, a Smodcast or something along those lines, right? I mean, it's going to be easier for them to be able to market it. So we have to think and work harder at it, but that's okay as long as you understand that the tools are out there and there are new ways to do things that nobody's thought of yet. I mean, the thing about the internet is there's so many ways to use it people haven't even thought of yet. You know, that's what's fascinating about it, and that's good for the comic book industry as well, and the small publishers.
Well, and I think another thing for us is that it helps make us smarter. And I think as long as you can always become smarter and always keep learning on this, then than, especially the people that 20, 30 years ago in comic books created the revolution for a small press, then it's like 30 years on now. Well, different people are going to create a new revolution in digital.
Absolutely, they are. Absolutely, they are. And, you know, those people who created that revolution in the small press had such a major, major influence down the road then on what the major publishers did. And you'll probably see the same thing. But I don't look for those major publishers necessarily be the ones, because those are the ones, they fear the internet will be a way for people to get their product for free, which it already is. So they're afraid of it. They're afraid to embrace it because they can get people all of a sudden will be able to access their books for free without paying for them. Well, you know what? People, I believe, all my heart, people will pay for a product that they think that they appreciate. They want to support that, and they'll want to support independent people. They'll also want to support the major publishers. But there are new ways to market in digital comic books, new ways to charge for ads during digital comic books. There's also, the technology is it's an exciting time. It's an exciting time for films. I mean, you see the DVD stores and the Blockbusters and places like that shutting down, and some people getting really, really upset. And I'm going, well, this is an exciting time that I can get other ways to get my entertainment. I can't wait to see what's coming up. This is great. It's, you know, but
well, for me,
you have the two different sides.
I'm happy because to me, we're spreading it out again. We're seeing a loss of control of people, of bigger groups being able to control and dominate everything and kind of like pigeonhole every customer and say like, well, if this is the way we're setting it up, so this is the way you have to do it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, comic books for a long time have had difficulty knowing how to market to younger children. They've been trying to do it. I mean, there came an age where comic books kind of grew up, and it was adults reading them. But finding the teenagers, the kids who are 10, 11, 12 years old, finding a way to market to them, they've tried all sorts of different things, launching kids' books and kids' versions of Spider-Man and this and that. The same thing, they've been for years attempting to find ways to get females to read comic books. The truth is, the internet gives you the tools to do these things much better than anything else ever has.
Well,
now you need to realize that and find a way.
I know that when I was younger, I mean, one of the best ways that a comic book could market towards me was boobies.
You know what? It's odd because today, one of the best ways comic books could market towards me is boobies.
Boobies, right, yes.
Yeah.
So it's
true,
good,
man,
to know
when
that.
I read Kazar, what's the name, Shara or
Shanna?
Shanna, that's it, the She-Devil. Oh, my God.
Well, and actually, when you look at Shanna the She-Devil, there's a 2005 miniseries by Frank Cho
from Liberty Meadows, brilliant artist. You know,
yeah, and I mean, it's one of those things that it's not the real Shanna the She-Devil, but what it is it's directly marketing towards that like teenage boy set, because you know it's got lots of big breasts, lots of dinosaurs, lots of blood, lots of gore.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So in other words, all the good stuff.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. All right, excellent. Well, you know what? Let's move on to a couple other subjects here. We hit digital comic books for just about forever.
We pretty much clubbed that one for now. Although the thing is that there's so much to be said about digital comic books.
Well, there is. And you know what? And we know we're going to hopefully receive a lot of feedback on that.
That's right.
Folks,
and,
you know.
And we're going to be touching on it again in many different shows.
And we'll probably have some theories on how people can use it and a discussion. Like we say, we're hoping to get some names on here. And yeah, it'll always be part of the show because it is the future and you can't ignore it. But let's move on to the success of the film division of Marvel Comics. This last weekend here, the Captain America displaced Harry Potter at the number one at the box office.
That's pretty damn good.
And this previous weekend here, this is the second weekend in release here now. But that was a huge, huge win for them, and it's something that a lot of people didn't see coming, actually. $65 million opening box office weekend. And Marvel's really on a roll, and they're having such great success. It seems like everything Marvel touches in the film industry turns to gold. Let's talk about that. Like I say, the success of the film division, $65 million opening for Captain America. And, yeah, everything they do is turn to gold. DC, on the other hand, really only feels like they have one property they can turn to gold outside of Batman. They've had limited success. Green Lantern had limited success. I mean, the Wonder Woman series never got off the air, really, or off the ground. You know, the way they tried to do that for television, Superman has had its problems. So what do you think it is that Marvel comic books are able to translate into the big screen better?
Well, I think one of the number one things when you look at Marvel and the reason that some, and I'm going to say some of their films really hit it big, because the thing is that
outside of Fantastic Four, pretty much most of them, and I guess, even Ghost Rider is having a sequel.
Yeah, Ghost Rider is having a sequel, and I mean, who's to say how good it's going to be? But the thing is that for a long time, I think Marvel tended to kind of farm out their products, and they didn't.
That's why you got the Roger Corman Fantastic Four, which, folks, speaking of how great the internet is, track that shit down. You'll laugh.
Well, I mean, I actually prefer that one to the big budget Fantastic Four.
Well, yeah, but that speaks more on the big budget than it does on the Roger Corman.
Well, it absolutely does.
But you know, the Captain America they did, the Dolph Lundgren Punisher. Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. with David Hasselhoff as they were kind of starting to put their fingerprints on their film division back when they did that one. But nevertheless,
As a side note, it is very interesting that I just happened to watch Captain America 2, the sequel to the television movies for Captain America made back in 1979 with Reb Brown as Captain America. And now, one of the reasons to watch it is because Christopher Lee plays General Miguel, the villain. But nice. the whole, and I mean, obviously, I mean, it was not a success or anything
really?
Like that. But I mean, the entire movie was really bad, and Reb Brown was not good at all. But my favorite element of it is the fact that it's that Captain America that has on the motorcycle helmet, and the shield is the windshield of the motorcycle.
That's beautiful. That's freaking brilliant. Excellent. Excellent.
But I think that right now, when you look at Marvel Studios' success, it's the fact that they're taking such a great hand in it. But the number one, like, their biggest movies are the movies that are tying in together to form the Avengers. Like, and I think this is where DC is really missing out, because they've said many times that they're not going to tie their movies together. They're not going to put The Dark Knight and Superman in the same universe.
No, that's a mistake, because, I mean, if they did a world's finest movie of any quality at all, you'd have to think that the box office would be just ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. But I think the thing is that Marvel's getting a lot of... I mean, when you started out with Iron Man, obviously it was a quality movie to begin with. But you look at that, and then the fact that it came into Iron Man 2, and then it's tying into Thor, and then the Captain America,
So why do you think Green Lantern failed then? Because, I mean, I guess I haven't seen it. The reviews on it weren't that good, but, I mean, it looked good. I saw the trailer. I was very impressed. There seemed to be nothing about it that didn't have me thinking it was going to be a big hit.
Well, and it's true, and the really interesting thing is that it has Geoff Johns attached to it, and so it surprises me that it would go off the rails.
Because his work writing, and the Green Lantern character has been absolutely spectacular.
Yeah, and you would really believe that he would be able to keep them on track and keep them focused on what a good quality story is.
And
because I think that's
he should know movies as well as the former. Assistant to Richard Donner?
Assistant to, yeah.
Yeah, so
Yeah, there's no question about it. Whereas Marvel is really keeping people focused on their movies, and I think that there's a lot of crossover. Like if somebody likes one, then they're more likely to go see the next one because they realize the tie-in.
But okay,
and they know.
But there was no tie-in at the beginning. There was no tie-in at. Okay, I guess the last one that didn't do as well as they hoped was the recent Hulk. Is that correct?
Right. I would think so.
And the first Hulk didn't do as well as they expected either.
Well, I mean, there's no question about that. I mean,
yeah, that was an absolute failure. The second one was a better movie.
Infinitely better.
Better. You did have the tie-in, I suppose, with Iron Man. But Iron Man came out before that. Why is it Iron Man at the time when it came out in no way appeared to have any crossover with the Avengers universe? We didn't see that coming really at the time. You know, there was the Nick Fury cameo that's really a...
Well, I think that in the case of the Nick Fury cameo and stuff like that, I think maybe they had the plan, and maybe what it was just to kind of like...
I think they had the plan.
Well, yeah. And I think it was just to throw it out there and to say like, hey, would you be interested in this? And then I think that people...
And then they put it in, they tacked it on at the end, and the crowd went crazy, right?
Yeah.
You know, but people went to that film, and they didn't go, what did that film, as before it had the Avengers universe attached to it, that film was this huge hit. And meanwhile, what did that film have that Green Lantern didn't have?
Well...
Do you know my comparison? Is it just a better quality film? Is that the end of the day, the issue?
Well, and I think... You know, that has to be it. I think you have to look at it. I mean, for the most part, when you look at comic book movies, especially, comic book fans tend to be really smart.
Yes.
And so I think that when you look at the movies, the worse off a movie, you know, then the worse off its box office, for the most part. Now, I mean, they're obviously...
Yeah. But you know what? You can't say an Iron Man and Green Lantern, though. I mean, it's not just comic book fans going.
No, of course it's not. But the thing is that the way that a movie maintains its life is through comic
books. That's true. That's true. Okay, well, you know what? I think, I don't know what DC can do to kind of relaunch it, you know, what the next character is. I would think The Flash.
Well, Once, we really need to see what the Man of Steel is going to be like.
Yeah, we need to really see if they actually ever complete it.
Well, I mean, they're going on with it. I mean, they're working on it. So, I mean, I have no reason.
I really enjoyed Superman Returns.
I did too. I think we're in the minority on that.
Oh, absolutely.
But
I'll say this: as much as I enjoyed it, it wasn't the Superman movie they needed to make. But also that. Even more so, it was incredibly poorly marketed.
Oh, yeah, it was horribly marketed.
So, you know, that's an issue. So, I mean, if they don't fix that, but yeah. Well, you know what, if we're going to talk about DC, you're leading into this, you've been trying to catch up on Marvel. Marvel's had a lot of big events lately, and I've been trying to catch up on DC and its big events. We're both fairly much caught up on one side, not on the other side. I'm almost caught up to everything DC Comics has done up to date. As far as their major events, you're almost out of everything in Marvel, I guess, right?
Well, I mean, I'm a little behind, but that's fine.
Just because there's been so much.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand that, and the problem is that it's not like all I'm reading is Marvel. I mean, I'm a huge fan of fan of Fables, huge fan of The Walking Dead. I mean, a lot of those great comics are out there, and so you those are
well, yeah, that's the thing. We're kind of really heavily concentrating on the. On kind of the superhero aspect and the DC comics, and don't worry, it will be on another show, but eventually we'll be talking about some of the other books like that, the more adult fare and the more independent stuff is, we're going to cover it all because we love it all, right?
Well, and I think one of the number one things is that when you look at Marvel and DC and the superhero stuff, is that it's usually often very much up and down and up and down, and you have the ebb and flow of the series, whereas I think when you have the smaller press, I mean, and I call Vertigo small press in this case, but I think that there's often often way more consistency with it, and so it tends to be that breath of fresh air that, oh, I needed that. That was so good.
Yeah.
And so you kind of get that from those books, and then you're able to carry on, and it kind of refreshes your love of the medium.
All right, let's get into this, though. I mean, I probably enjoy the DC Universe a little bit more than the Marvel Universe, but I'm a big fan of both. But the DC Universe has, we talked a little bit of Marvel and their film division. Let's talk about what DC has coming up, unless there's anything else on Marvel you want to hit today.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure that we'll be getting into Spider Island coming up soon, but
We will. But you know what? We already find ourselves doing a good show here, and we have those interviews to get to. And one of those interviews, who are the two people we plan to throw into our interviews today?
Well, today, I mean, we're gonna bring up Mike Mignola, fantastic creator, of course, creator of Hellboy. And then later on, we're going to be talking with Neil Adams. And if you need an introduction to Neil Adams, then you probably shouldn't be listening to this podcast.
Yeah, you probably don't understand comic books at all. He's a legend and one of the most influential and greatest creators in history. And it's very interesting. We were talking about the embracing of technology earlier, because he is in probably, what is he, late 60s, early 70s?
Actually, you know, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's something like that, though. You know, he's up there, and he, on the other hand, has always been very accepting and willing to embrace new technology, and that's part of the interview there. So that'll tie in nicely. But let's just quickly what do you want to do here? You want to go to that Mignola, or do you want to go to did I say his name right?
Well,
there, Mignola.
Mignola. Yeah. Mignola. Yes.
You asked him that at the beginning of the interview.
Straight from the horse's mouth. So to speak.
Yeah. Do you want to do that, or do you want to talk a little bit about the relaunch of some of the DC comics here?
Let's just for a couple of quick minutes touch on the DC relaunch, because I mean, right now it is a huge hot button issue in the industry.
That's the thing. I mean, nobody cares if they're they're relaunching, DC Universe Presents, but people are pissed off that they're relaunching Action Comics, and Detective Comics and these type of things. So, what's your take on this?
Well, my number one concern, and I'm not talking from a retailer perspective, because that's one of the keys in about Neil Adams talking about it in our interview, is he kind of hits it from a retailer perspective. But one of my concerns from just a fan perspective is that I'm wondering if it's going to be like when Marvel, kind of shut down those four books. The Age of Apocalypse and stuff like that. Onslaught. That was Onslaught.
Onslaught, yeah. Captain America, Thor. What were the other two? Iron Man.
What was it? Iron Man and
was it Avengers?
Well, I want to say Avengers, because that makes sense. Yeah. Now, I could be wrong on that, so don't take me at my word right now. But I think it's one of those cases where back then, when those things occurred, the sales were nowhere near what they anticipated, and so they had to kind of fast track it back to the way it was.
Well, why don't you give a little bit more of an overview of that period for someone who may not be familiar with Onslaught and the history behind that?
Well, I mean, the key was the idea was that with Marvel was they had lost so many creators to Image that they were finding that their sales were kind of tanking a little bit. And so I think that when Onslaught came in...
Was this about 1993, 1994, somewhere in that range?
I want to say yes. I think that would...
Yeah, 1995.
Yeah, probably.
Somewhere. I think 94, 95, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, I think that's right.
If I remember correctly.
And so the key is that what they did was to save the Marvel Universe. These groups that were formed into the got shot into a separate universe, and so their titles all rebooted with Image creators attached to them. So you had your Jim Lees, you had your Wills Portacio.
Yeah, Jim Lee, I believe, was doing Iron Man, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and Rob Liefeld was doing Captain America.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. So you had these guys, and they, and the idea was that the sales would just you know, be phenomenal because you had these awesome image creators that, that were so important. And then
pretty much all the big image creators, except for, well, McFarlane did not do one.
No, McFarlane and
Silvestri, did he not?
Silvestri may have, but and I don't think Valentino was involved.
No, Valentino was not. I believe at that time he was actually editor-in-chief at Image.
So. Yeah, and he's been, you know, in that role a lot, so.
Yeah. So anyway, so basically their idea was to relaunch the books, and what they did was they relaunched the Onslaught series, and then when the characters came back into the Marvel Universe from Onslaught, they relaunched all the books at number one. So Captain America was at number one. Captain America was funny. That was probably the series which got screwed the worst in this, because it had had poor sales for many years, and then right before they did this, Mark Waid was writing it and was getting really good reviews, and its sales were in a high upward trend, and it cut into the middle of his storyline before it got finished, if you remember correctly.
Yeah, and then, of course, when it came back...
he went back on it, but it never regained that momentum.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so it was the series, but you know, I mean, they relaunched an Iron Man and a Thor, all this stuff at number one, and their theory, and they started redoing this as well. They relaunched Spider-Man at number one. They relaunched all these series at number one, not necessarily the continuity like DC is doing, but the theory being that people would look at an issue and go, "This is Spider-Man number 532. Oh shit, so much stuff has happened. I don't know what's going on. I'll never be able to know what's going on. It's too intimidating. That number is too intimidating." I don't buy that theory at all.
Well, and another problem, I think, especially in the mid-90s, and that's one of those things that I'm questioning right about now, is this idea of number ones were way more valuable to a collector than a number 532. So the more that you relaunched a series, the more number ones you will have. Therefore, the more collectors will want to buy... especially your 8 million versions of said number one issue.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The thing is, I don't think the numbers are the high numbers. When I see the high number, when I was a kid and I saw, you know, Batman was on, like, issue 420, I didn't look at it and think that was intimidating. I thought, oh, how cool. This must be good. It's been around forever, and it's got so much history. That's awesome. I want to jump on
that. But
That was my thing.
Yeah, but in the mid-90s, that was, you know, in the early 90s, you're talking about comic boom time. So the truth is that...
And this was after the boom. This was when they were really trying to relaunch it after you had the boom, then you had the crash. You know, about 95, right?
But I think that...
And the boom was really like 92, 93.
Well, sure. But those ideas carried over. And especially if you're crashing, well, what do you do? You try to go right back to what was just working for you.
Yep, absolutely. Now, DC is what they're doing is essentially they're taking their characters and they're basically making the ultimate, like the Ultimate Universe was designed by Marvel to be more accessible to new fans. Because, I mean, if you look at Thor, it's not on number, 120 or whatever it would be all this time later. It's back to the 700s or wherever it would be, because ultimately what they did was they put in, like, it would say, you know, Thor number 140, and then on the left hand corner it would say the actual number, and then eventually they just got rid of the 140 and would start carrying on with the normal continuity of where the book would be if they hadn't relaunched
it.
That's
right.
Because, you know, so anyways, what DC's doing here is basically trying to do the Ultimate Universe, what Marvel did with the Ultimate Universe, but Marvel set up a separate universe to do it, not to screw with the current continuity or the fans of that. DC is doing it with their current, trying to make it more accessible and more younger and hipper and all this stuff. They're doing it with their current universe instead of setting up a separate one, even though they actually have been setting up a separate one that's now kind of being tossed out. They've just done something with Superman.
Well, and
but
the weird thing about it, though, with DC is the fact that they're not relaunching every book. There's like X amount of books that are just staying the same. So it's kind of like, how do those fit in with?
Well, they are going to be called number one still. They're going to all have a number one issue. I don't know if the I believe it. I don't know if the numbering is going after they're all number ones, if the number is going back to where it would be, or, you know, I mean, Green Lantern Corps is still going to have a new number one issue, but they're not necessarily, like you say, they're not really necessarily doing the Ultimate Universe with that. Is that what you're saying?
No, I actually believe that there are some series that are carrying on their existing numbering system.
Perhaps. I know that they're launching 52 books as the number one, because they love that concept of 52.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see what does kind of shake down from it, as, you know, and we're getting really close to the launch.
Morrison is continuing his Batman Incorporated storyline, for instance. I mean, that's not going to be screwed with, because you don't screw with what Morrison has set up and been writing for a couple of years if you're DC.
DC, because you want to keep Morrison in the fold.
Well, DC, I mean, the DC universe is largely Geoff Johns and Grant Morrison's playground. You know, it's their playground. They can do whatever they want. Everybody else does around it.
Yeah,
you
with know, Jim Lee as the ref, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And whereas Bendis is, you know, Marvel is his playground.
Yeah.
You know, it's his playground. He lets other kids in when he wants. Essentially, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, again, that's worked very well for Marvel, so I
oh, yeah, absolutely. That. I'm not saying that's wrong. No. I'm just saying that's what it is, you know? Action Comics, Superman, what they're doing with that, their Ultimate Universe-ing that, I guess you could say, for lack of better terms. What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on relaunching that and Superman in a pair of jeans?
Well, I mean, that I got nothing good to say about that concept. The truth is that I'm interested in seeing, is it going to be like Superman when they split him off into the Red Superman and Blue Superman, you know, which lasted, again, a grand total of, whatever, 2-3 months, and that seemed way too long. And so I think that it's one of those concepts, like I'm really concerned that it's just going to be so awful, because no matter how you shake it down, everybody wants to see Superman in the same basic outfit, and we've seen it time and time again where people change the outfit of an iconic character, you know, like Batman, like Superman, and it lasts for like
Spider-Man,
it lasts for 2-3 months, and then the sales start dropping.
Even Wolverine's, the height of his popularity was when he had that orange-brown outfit. Even he went back to the yellow-blue outfit that was his original one.
That's right. And
you know,
everybody wants to change something. Like, every writer, every artist wants to bring their own take to the character because they feel like, hey, this is my moment. If I can take this character and revamp them and everybody loves it, I will be a legend.
Yeah, that's why you have to put somebody else in the Fantastic Four instead of just the four that it is, you know?
Yeah, it's
happened a billion times, right?
Well, we need She-Hulk in there. And then, of course, you know, the next writer comes on, and it's just like, hey, I want the real Fantastic Four. I want to be doing that. And then, of course, you know, a year later, they're like, you know, I'm sick of this. Let's kill Johnny Storm.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you got the Action Comics. It was more than that. I mean, obviously, one of the big things is Lois Lane is going to have a boyfriend, not married to Superman. He's going to have both of his parents are killed already. Both Jonathan and Ma Kent are dead going into this. Like I say, they're really messing with what they set up for a long time. Obviously, like that different outfit. Now, I'm okay with the different outfit. In the early 90s, just before that onslaught, there was right after the Azrael was Batman and all that crap. Dick Grayson was in a storyline called Prodigal Son, I believe it was called, and coming out of that, they changed the Batman outfit. Basically, they just got rid of the
shorts.
The shorts, yeah, exactly. And they gave it a slightly grayer, more darker color, and it looks so much better, so much more realistic. Then they went back to the shorts. I don't know why. Get rid of the shorts. The same thing with Superman. I don't think you have to do a lot different with the book. The shorts look stupid.
DC really liked underpants.
DC really liked underpants on the outside.
Yeah,
and
it's fairly obvious that they're briefs over boxers.
Yeah, exactly. They, and you know what? I'm the boxer brief guy, personally.
Well, you know,
but,
I mean...
But that was too much information.
But the truth of the matter is that I would absolutely love to see Superman with a pair of boxers with, like, smiley faces on outside of his tights. Or perhaps even Superman logos on his boxers outside of his regular tights.
Yeah, that's... Then they'll finally go back to selling all those issues they used to sell.
Yeah, that's right.
No. I'm okay with revamping the basic Superman costume because it's kind of stupid and it's 1930s. Jeans, though, is dumb. Now, I don't know if they're going to stay with this. I've heard blue bodysuit. Just take it. Just tweak it to modernize it. Don't do too damn much. As far as Lois Lane as Superman, it's just restarting a storyline that I've seen a million times that's going to end up in the same place anyway.
Well, it's but
they think it's more, you know, they think it's more accessible.
Well,
then.
It's the same thing that they've been trying desperately to do with Spider-Man for so many years. You know, you realize that once a character...
He's still married to Mary Jane to me.
Well, and he is married to Mary Jane in the, or, you know, like in various points. Like, I mean it's back and forth, You know, and I think it's just one of those cases where you know, it's really hard, and it's the same as television. It's really hard when you put those two main characters together or marry them off. Again, it's you don't want to carry on with it for after a while. You realize that it's just like, oh, well, they're happy together. Well, where's the interest
in that? Well, you've always seen it, right? You saw it in Moonlighting and Cheers and all these television shows where, you know, Northern Exposure, when they finally kiss or make love or whatever, it ruins the series. You've seen it, you know, I wish I could name a modern television show, but I can't.
That would mean you'd have to
too
watch
busy reading comic books and watching wrestling, folks. But, playing fantasy football, which will be our next podcast coming. But, yeah, so, I mean, but it's true. Conflict is what drives storylines, right? If there's no conflict, then I understand that, but I think sometimes, and DC has to feel that they're trying to get their sales up, and they've done quality books, so this is a, I don't know if it's necessarily a knee-jerk reaction, but they think it's time, but here's my thing about all this. I'm really pissed off that they're doing this to Detective Comics. I'm pissed off they're doing this to Superman. I wish they weren't. I liked it the way it was. All that said, I look at the quality of people working on these books. I'm like, how could these books not be awesome? What they're doing, I know they'll be a damn good read.
Well, and they have to be. Because I think, again, it's such a polarizing issue that if you were to come out and you know, it's just like, it's Detective Comics written by Joe Schmuck, you know, penciled by Joe Luzer.
Well, it's written by Tony Daniel. Well, I mean, Detective Comics is going to continue to be done by Tony Daniel as it has been. Action Comics, though, I mean, you look at Grant Morrison, Rags Morales. I mean, it'll be great, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you've got a high quality duo there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's gonna be great. Superman done by George Perez, writing it. I mean, you got this old school legendary creator who's doing this modern take on this character. I mean,
Of course, I
want to see it.
And he's a fantastic artist, I mean, so...
Yeah, it was just one of the best ever. One of the greatest ever, you know? Batman is being done by Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. Greg Capullo, of course, I think most well-known for taking over for McFarlane on Spawn for many, many years.
Yeah.
His hand-picked protege. You know, I mean, the quality of people in the DC universe... creating the books is as good as it ever has been. So there's no reason to think that this stuff won't be great. I mean, Justice League, Geoff Johns and Jim Lee, hell yeah, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, no question. And the Justice League International by Dan Jurgens, I mean...
Yeah, and Justice League
Dark.
That's
all I need.
Peter Milligan, right?
Yeah.
Like great talent. So, I mean, we'll probably get into what is exciting us more down the road here. But that's the thing. I mean, I really want to be angry at DC. At the end of the day, I'm sitting there, I'm conflicted because I don't like these moves. But God damn it if it's not going to be good to read. It's not going to be fun.
Well, and I really hope it is, because, I mean, at the end of the day, as a comic book fan, the number one thing that you have to ask and demand out of every book that you read is that it's good.
Yeah. And that's the other thing now. Let's get into this, you know. I mean, and you know, Wonder Woman by Brian Azzarello. How do you pronounce his name? Azzarello?
Azzarello?
Yeah. Well, it's a tongue twister, folks. But
well, everything's a tongue twister for you.
Well, that's true. That's true. You know what? People who listen to me on We Talk Wrestling would be surprised that I read. But nevertheless, you know, I'm thinking that what they're going to do here will stick. We talk about how Onslaught didn't stick. When they did relaunch in the mid-'80s, 1985, after a crisis, that new continuity stuck. But what do you think? Do you think this... I do think they'll eventually go back to the numbering of Superman and Action Comics and this stuff. At least the one, you know...
Well, for sure, the big ones, you know, for sure, the Superman Detective Action, those ones. I mean, there's no way that you leave decades and decades of numbering and just leave it and go away from it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, can you imagine the concept when Action Comics, of leaving it and with the potential? Because Action Comics will actually hit 1,000.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that would be great.
And it doesn't even have to be like fake Radioactive Man numbering where you go from 333 to 999 to, you know, 1268 or whatever. You know, exactly. It doesn't have to be that kind of fake numbering. It's real.
But that actually that does bring up one other thing, though. Action Comics Weekly. Now, I don't really remember. I was a little bit out of reading comic books at this time. And also, you didn't have an internet to see, you know, if a group of people was upset in the same way. You know, it wasn't as easy to gauge. But were people against that move at the time? Do you recall?
Well, you know, that was at the time when people would pretty much buy whatever the hell you threw in front of them. Because, I mean, for a very long time as well, Spider-Man went bi-monthly, you know. Bi-weekly, sorry, and X-Men.
That's right, yeah.
As well, you know, like, so it was happening a lot. The thing that DC tried to do when they made Action Comics Weekly was they put in the backup stories.
Yeah, that's right. They had a Superman lead-in story, and then they rotated a different backup story, 8-page backup story with the four issues. It was, I think, it was a Green Lantern, Mad Dog, my favorite,
Wild Dog,
I mean.
Yeah,
Wild Dog. My favorite, woo! Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Green Lantern, I think, had one. Wild Dog. I can't recall who else. But
Black Hawk was in there, I believe.
That's right. Black Hawk was in there. The point being, though, I mean, we're sitting here and bitching. This is nothing new. You know, comic books have always tried to do something new like this, to grab the interest of the readers.
Yeah, oh yeah, and there's no question that they'll always do it, and everything is cyclical, so we'll always be seeing the same ideas just refreshed, you know, every 20 years.
Now, okay, let's all right. I think we've covered this to some degree. We'll talk more about some of the smaller issues on another show. This is going a little long, so let's get to our interviews here. We're going to open up with the Mignola, are we?
Yeah, absolutely. He's he's Mike frickin' Mignola. I mean,
it was a good first get.
Yeah, and I mean, people love Hellboy. I love Hellboy.
Hellboy's great.
I love the amazing screw-on head.
Yeah.
You know, as a writer, he's solid, but as an artist, I mean, once you understand, for me, and it took me a while to understand his art style, but once I did...
Well, we can say this, when Hellboy was first launching, and more than that, he was getting a lot of covers, especially for things like Batman, Detective Comics, actually, I think it was Detective Comics his covers were largely for, that was at the time when you and I had a store, and we'd look at it and think it was crap, and then, until I had an artist come in and explain to me what he was doing, I didn't get it. But even then, I wasn't a big fan of the covers until I read a Hellboy series,
mm-hmm.
And then I really got the art,
yeah,
and really understood the style and what he was doing. and really loved it.
Well, and I think, and actually, if you go even far back to his really early stuff, you know, the world of Krypton, et cetera, then if you were to ask him, he would suggest that it was crap as well.
Yeah, that was a far more, let's call it a mainstream style that he started
with. Yeah, and Mignola is not a guy who likes the work for hire element. He's a guy who likes working for himself and being able to do everything the way he wants it to be done.
So here we go. Let's launch right into this. Brett and Mike Mignola at the Calgary Entertainment Expo 2011.
Hit it. Okay, so my first question is, what's it like now to see artists who are being influenced by your work and at times will emulate your work?
You know, I'm usually the last person to recognize that somebody's doing me. Plus, I don't look at a lot of comics, so I hear about people doing me and I hear that I'm a big influence, but I usually don't see it. But it's nice. I mean, it's always flattering that you make, you know, that you're influential. So, you know, it's nice. As long as they're not doing me better than I am.
How long did it take you to kind of create your art style?
Well, I'm 50 years old. It took 50 years. You know, it's not like something you wake up one day and go, oh, you know what? I need a style. I'll figure it out. I've been doing this stuff professionally for 25 years or more. So it's 25 years of doing it wrong and trying to adjust it and you know, this works and this doesn't work. So it's just an ongoing evolutionary process. It's probably only within the last 5 years that I started kind of being happy with, you know, what I do.
Now, when you first started Hellboy, you had John Byrne write it. And then afterwards you took over the writing. Now, was that overly stressful for you? Was that something that was kind of intended?
Well, I think John Byrne always intended it. John knew I should write the book myself. I just didn't have the confidence to do it. I'd never, you know, written a full script before. So I plotted the first Hellboy miniseries myself, and then I kind of roughed in the dialogue, and John was like my training wheels. You know, he rewrote everything, and it was great. But by the end of that first miniseries, we were both very aware that I should be doing it myself. Nothing against what John did. I could never have done the book without him. But as he did things, I was kind of going, kind of liked what I had there better. So there was no conflict at all between John and I as far as him leaving the book. Basically, he just said, now, kid, you're on your own. That first story I did on my own, which was The Wolves of St. August, was amazingly stressful because there's nothing more scary than doing a job and you're the only guy. Even on Wolf St. August was originally published in black and white. So there were no professionals other than me involved in that book. So that was amazingly stressful. The second one I wrote myself, The Corpse, I kind of was able to relax and just have fun. And after I did The Corpse, I thought, well, okay, if I can get away with the comic being like this, then yeah, maybe I can write this thing myself.
So then after that, now how do you feel that your skills as a writer have evolved now that you're doing it? Like, where do they stand in relation to your feeling as an artist?
Well, I will always be most comfortable as an artist. You know, it's what I've done forever. I think as a writer I've gotten better. I think I've been very fortunate to work with some wonderful artists. But I will always be most comfortable as an artist. And even when I write for other people, I have to like do little rough thumbnails and stuff for the story for myself, just because the only way I can write is to kind of conceive of how the story paces out and, you know, zoom in here and close up here and pull back here. I need to put in those kind of instructions because that's, I can't help but see the story.
How do you feel about the fact that now that BPRD is becoming quite successful in its own right, how, like, secondary characters that you've created are almost as popular as the primary character, Hellboy?
It's great. I mean, I just think, I love that. One of the things I'm most proud of is the way this whole Hellboy universe thing has kind of evolved. Hang on one second. Here's... Yeah, I'm very proud of the fact that this kind of universe has kind of grown, you know, very organically, and certain characters have taken on a life of their own. And, you know, BPRD, frankly, BPRD has a better writer on it. John Arcudi is a much better writer than I am. And he's so good with characters, and he's breathed so much life into characters that I wouldn't really have known what to do with. I didn't have big plans for Abe Sapien. I didn't have big plans for Liz Sherman. So we have a really good, comfortable working relationship where we discuss stuff all the time, but the more I leave John alone to do what he does, really the better it is.
How much do you like to be involved with your work once it kind of leaves your table, like in the case of the Hellboy movie or any of the other stuff that has gotten made based on your characters?
Well, I mean, it's nice that the filmmaker wanted me involved on the Hellboy movie. And certainly it was a really fun experience, especially on the first one, being there for this, you know, this thing being developed as a film. But as I get older, you know, and I get a lot more precious about my time, I'd rather spend my time in the studio. A lot of the time you spend working on a film, it's doing work that nobody ever sees that may or may not have any effect on the film. So as I get, you know, as I get more precious about my time, I'd rather spend it in the studio so that I know what I'm drawing is actually going to be published. You know, I'm not just working for a paycheck or working on, well, maybe we'll do this or maybe we'll do that. You know, I want to sit down and draw something and know that that's going to be published as is.
That was good stuff, Brett. And you know what? I really do think that was a very interesting. I think he appreciated the tone of the interview. So I think we got a lot out of it, and I hope people enjoyed it.
Well, and
that.
I think another thing about him, like, and actually, I mean, being able to talk to him was really interesting because he's.
Well, what was the setting like and the kind of the mood going into the interview? And
well,
such?
It's tough because everything that I'd heard about Mignola was the fact that talking to him earlier, he's really kind of intimidating in a fashion. You know, I heard mm-hmm. a story,
and you had warned me of that as well. Yeah. I was off to the side while you were doing the interview.
Yeah, because I had heard a story before about somebody having brought up one of those earlier comics to have him sign, and he almost, you know, like threw the comic away, just because he's yeah. so against that element of his career. And so I was really concerned going into it that it's just like, oh, is he going to be grouchy? You know, and he even said that right off the bat, you know, about like, oh, you're catching me at the end of the day kind of thing. And it's just like, oh, what's it going to be like? Am I going to get chewed up and spit out? But the thing is that, and it's like you say about the tone of the questions, I think as long as, you know, we were respectful, you know, and we're also really interested because I really do appreciate his work. And so I think yeah. that helps, and it shows when you're...
I think he can sense that, and he can also sense that... I also think that people just don't want to hear the same questions they've been asked 100 times. They want to have to think about what... They want to have questions posed to them where they have to think of something in a different way, because then it's interesting to them as well. So I think that came across
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it just really helps. And I mean, I think it's a great interview, and he's definitely a fantastic guy, and I wish him all the success.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anything else about the interview, about any of the comments that he made that you want to say?
I think it's refreshing to kind of hear him suggest that, you know, that he's not the best writer and that he recognizes that. And I think that it really bodes well for him down the line and for us as fans down the line, because it means that he's going to constantly strive to get better.
Yeah, and you know what? I think he's a better writer than he knows.
Yeah, and I think he is. You know, so I mean, yeah, I think it's excellent, and I really look forward to following his career.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. All right. Well, and speaking of careers, the legendary career of Neil Adams. Neil Adams, of course. What was the original? I'm trying to remember the name of the company he was working with before he moved to DC. Timely.
Timely, I think Timely.
Yeah, Timely. That's, I think, where he kind of broke in and got his start, Timely Comic Books. He's been around for an awful, awful long time, but where he really turned heads was with the Green Lantern, Green Arrow series in the early 70s, a groundbreaking teaming of those two. Those books that, to this day, go and read them. If you haven't read them, find a way to read them. They hold up not just much better than almost any book from the 70s. They hold up both in style and in content.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I fell in love with Neil Adams' work based on those books. You know, you would struggle very hard.
And we talked to him about it in this interview here. You had an opportunity to bring those
That's
up
right.
as well. And the answer's fascinating. So let's let him say what he has to say. It was a very different interview because he's the opposite. You're told that he loves
well,
to talk.
Yeah, he's really loquacious, and I think that one of the interesting things about this, just to kind of preface this interview, is that now when I was able to sit down at his table with him, I mean, it was really nice to be able to sit down, because with Mignola I was standing while he was sitting, so it's a different
it's
a different balance. But in this case, you know, we were sitting down, it was like a.
Well, he had to go through his wife to be able to secure the interview, and he was there with his two sons, was it? Or one son?
I know. One son, yeah, one son for sure.
One son is also an artist who seems to be, I haven't had a chance to really sample his work, but from what I saw at the expo, was really, really
yeah,
good
absolutely.
As well.
Well,
so.
He's got a great teacher. But I yeah, think, you know, set. Just to preface it, like, it was explained to us beforehand that in the case of Neil Adams, that he generally will carry on signing and sketching while you're doing the interview. But the number one thing that I found interesting about our interview with him is the fact that he actually stopped. He stopped doing everything dead. Like, he would like motion to go back to sketching or start to maybe think about signing another autograph, but he stopped. And
the whole time,
it was just, we were focused. And so, I mean, that was amazing.
Yeah, and you know what? And coming out of the interview, some of the
We'll get into that at the end here.
Let's cut to the interview and on comic books and one other interesting subject that we get to as well. Neil Adams, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, so my first question is, many people consider the work that you and Denny O'Neill did on Green Lantern and Green Arrow to be among the most groundbreaking of the 70s. And so I'm kind of wondering, looking back, did you realize the potential legacy of those story arcs?
I didn't care. I mean, I was doing comic books and I was telling stories, and I didn't like to do things that were insignificant. I don't think Denny liked to either. But I don't really like to do something that people have seen before or have read before or have experienced before. I would rather do something that people find new, are shocked by or surprised by or taken by, so that my goal is to, unfortunately in all of this, to satisfy myself and not to break ground or any of the rest of it. I don't care about that stuff. I just care about making myself happy.
So then, what are the other projects that you've worked on that have probably made you the happiest?
Well, I did a lot of work for the National Lampoon, Son of God Comics, VD Comics, a lot of satirical stuff. I've designed amusement park rides like the Terminator T2 3D ride, part of the Spider-Man ride. I worked on Warp. I did the costumes and the on the stage set, a stage set that had never been done before, and a way of presenting that had never been done before. I won the Drama Desk Award for that year. I like doing the Superman versus Muhammad Ali comic book as a giant comic book because it really allowed me to express the comic book format. I like doing Dead Man because he was dead. Now he's alive. I don't know why, how exactly that works. And Dead Man was a great story. I like doing stories that people haven't seen. I like doing, I like the work I did for Warren, where these series of short stories that were sort of horror stories, but weren't really horror stories, each one done in a different style. I like to do experimental things. I don't like to do the mundane. And I like to find new ways of doing things. One of the reasons I like to do covers is that I get to express new ideas. I did a series of painted covers for Tarzan. I mean, really, my life is filled with doing new and different things, but not escaping into impressionistic art or surrealistic art or going into creating another art form that people either don't understand or don't care about. I like staying in an understandable art form that people can enjoy. So it's my communication with them. That's what it's all about for me.
Now, your Continuity Studios also has directed motion comics and done a lot of your work. So now, when you're doing that work, do you feel that that's just a natural progression of how you started, or is it something that you enjoy more, perhaps?
Doing that sort of stuff for me is breaking new ground. It doesn't necessarily mean it's new or dynamic or wonderful. It's sometimes you do things for the sake of breaking the new ground, even though you know it's mundane. Like, say, taking animatics, I've done for advertising for 30 years, into comic books. Now, from my point of view, it's mundane and regular, because I've done it for advertising people for 30 years. For comic books, it's new. So now I've created a revolution in comics by doing these things that isn't really a revolution at all. It's common practice in advertising. So that also is a new idea, taking something that's common practice in one place and applying it to a comic book. I mean, wouldn't you like to be able to open a comic book and have it appear in 3D without having put glasses on? Is there a technology for that? I don't know, but I'd like to do that. I'd like to do things that... I mean, there's a thing that is extant recently where you create three-dimensional objects with your computer and honing them in on a piece of printed graphic that's on your cover. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. But it seems like a really interesting direction. Holograms seem like an interesting direction, but they, at the same time, they seem like a dead end. But they're not a dead end. You just have to do it right. You have to find ways of doing it. So technology is something that you mix in with what you do like. We mix in computers for motion comics. So the motion comics become a totally new thing that it seemed as though nobody ever thought of before. Of course, I've been trying to sell it to DC and Marvel for 10 years. So, I mean, nothing is new. It's just a remix of what we already know. And I like that a lot. I like to do it. I like to surprise people. I like people to be taken aback by a thought process that they never experienced and turns out to be better than the one that they've never done. I love that. I just get such a charge.
So I'm just going to quickly ask you about what do you think of DC relaunching all the titles, especially Detective Comics?
I find it to be worrisome. It seems as though they're trying to ace creatives out, but maybe they're not. It seems as though they're trying to make it very difficult for small publishers to stay in business, but maybe they're not. I think it's an attack on the lower tier of the Marvel comics, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's done in all innocence. Maybe it's just like, we're going to try this. Or maybe it's a conscious effort to reclaim their first position in comics by doing something that I have to consider questionable. I mean, I don't want to take them down for it, and I don't want to majorly criticize them, but I do have to say that on the surface of it, it seems to be uncomfortably suspicious. And I would prefer that people could feel better about it. And I think that small publishers in particular have something to sweat about here. It bothers me a lot.
So last couple of questions. I just want to ask you to if you can sum up the expanding Earth. Three.
Well, it's not the expanding Earth. It's the growing Earth. Why do you care about it?
I was just interested because you know, I mean,
on a personal basis. Or?
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of done some reading about you and kind of, you know, kind of going into focus because I was also interested in They Spoke Out, Voices Against the Holocaust.
Well, I think people would tend to laugh at me about the growing Earth theory and take me more seriously on the Holocaust stuff. I'll answer the question. I don't mind. We have to. This is not really for your regular audience, but you have to assume that the universe, matter portion of the universe, was created somehow out of seemingly nothing. So if you understand that, because it can't have been created out of something, because when did it start? I mean, if you assume that it always was and always will be world without end, amen, that's religious. If you assume it started out with no matter, then you have to come up with a mechanism that provides that matter. And nobody has come up with that mechanism. Nor did I ever think that I would ever come up with that mechanism until I had to deal with, or I felt I had to deal with, Samuel Warren Carey's theory on the expanding Earth. Samuel Warren Carey was a geologist. He was not a physicist. Had he been a physicist, he never would have said expanding Earth because it's a ridiculous title. But if he had been a physicist, he might have said growing Earth, except he never would have come up with that theory because it takes a geologist to notice that the Earth is growing. But if you are a geologist and you're as smart as Sam Carey, you notice that the Earth is growing because there's no deep ocean on the Earth that's older than 180 million years old. And successively, there's 50% of the deep ocean is only 50 million years old, or between 50 and 60 million years old. So it seems as though the Earth is, one, growing, two, growing exponentially, and that the oceans are spreading exponentially, unless you don't believe facts, which is fine. So if that's the case, you're left with a problem. First of all, you have to prove that the Earth is growing, which nobody wants to believe because geology had a big battle with Samuel Warren Carey in which they felt that they won and then ignored him and didn't explore it further, which was a mistake. It's always a mistake when you don't explore further. Then you have the problem of, let's just say he's right, then how then do you apply that to the universe? You can't just say the Earth grows. You have to say the moon grows and all the planets grow. You have to say the sun grows. You have to say solar systems grow, galaxies grow, and the universe grows. Well, that actually matches what we see. The universe does seem to be growing. Some people say expanding, but that's just as stupid as when a geologist says the Earth is expanding. The universe can't be expanding unless you can prove that it exploded. Well, you can't prove that it exploded because 15 years ago we showed that it's moving outward faster all the time, exponentially faster. Well, that's not how an explosion works. An explosion slows down. So clearly that's wrong. Well, now you're left with the original problem. What is the universe doing? Well, what is a tree doing? What is a baby doing? What is a giant jellyfish doing? They're all growing. So if we're in the ocean of the universe and matter is growing, then we're looking at a very simple phenomenon. A very simple phenomenon is that the matter portion of the universe is increasing and therefore taking up more space and seemingly growing. It's not growing like an animal, but it's growing. It's increasing. Then it must have started very small, very tiny. And if it did, then there is an explanation for that, and you have to figure out that explanation. You have to look through science and see, one, if it's only going to be discovered in the future, or we already know it. Is there a process of matter creation that exists now? Well, you know, the funny thing is there is. There is a process of matter creation. It's called pair production. And not only is there such a process, but scientists are exploring it in their colliders to discover whether or not pair production happened in a massive way in the new universe, in a universe that's being created. They are actually talking about it, something that I'm talking about, on a fairly regular basis. They are also disgusting, but they've run into problems that magically I haven't run into. I have found the answers to those problems. Now, that's going to upset the physicists, but I've already upset all the geologists in the world, so who gives a crap? Physicists are going to have to deal with the concept that their general theories are wrong, and that we have to use pair production as the beginning of an explanation of how matter is created. If all of that is true on the physics end, we come back to the geology of the Earth. And that goes to, if that process is taking place at the core of the Earth on a regular and active basis, regular, active, and mundane basis, then not only is the Earth growing, we can explain exactly how it's growing. Not only is the Earth growing, but Jupiter's growing and becoming the meteorite umbrella of Earth. That's why we don't get big meteorite hits. All the planets are growing, all suns are growing, and the universe is growing. And now we're starting to actually understand the universe. The bad part of all of that is that's coming from a comic book artist and writer. That shits. You know, it's like, wow. Can't we put it in the hands of somebody who's smart?
Hey, Brett, that was great. Let's say legendary character. You know, again, tell me what happens after you got off.
Well, the thing is, you know, is that A, like, you were motioning me, like, because I had to wrap the interview up. And so it was interesting because he just wouldn't stop talking.
I had to get out of there,
unfortunately. And so I knew that, you know, like, that we could probably keep talking to him for hours, you know, and
I would love to pick that brilliant mind of his for much longer if we ever had an opportunity. And that's it. It comes across the level of intelligence of this man.
No question.
Is so, so powerful, and it comes across in this interview.
But no, the best part, and this is really this is one of the things that solidified it for me, was the fact that, you know, as I was getting up, one of the fans that was in line, he looked at me and he said, "That was so cool. You are so lucky to have been able to do that." And it gave me pause because I sat down, I walked over and I thought to myself, he's right. The fact that I was able to spend 15 minutes talking to Neil Adams, kind of like mano a mano, you know, that is really cool. That is awesome.
And the fact that people in line weren't upset with having to wait because they got to sit in on it. You know, they weren't upset to have to wait because there was something in there, you know, panel quality discussion there that people would enjoy.
Because there's no question that I had that, you know, these people standing over me. I had that concern kind of in the back of my head of like...
Yeah, I did too for you.
Are they going to kill me when I get up?
Yeah. You know what? But they didn't. Everybody really enjoyed it. And I was off to the side where I couldn't really hear it so well. So when I got a chance to listen back to it, I was like, this came across brilliantly. Now, what about the content of what he got to? Anything there you want to comment on?
Well, it's really hard to comment on the content because there's so much content. You know, I think that the real interesting thing, and the number one thing that I love about Neil Adams, is I love the fact that he's always trying to be a pioneer.
Yeah.
I love the fact that, you know, he does motion comics. I love the fact that he directs other things. I love...
You say the technology, he absolutely embraces it far more, you know, far more than so many others. And that's it. There was a couple of really interesting subjects that we didn't even get an opportunity to talk to him about. This, like, oh man, I would love to have heard him talk on that.
Oh, no question. I mean, like we said earlier, we could talk to him for hours.
Yeah. What about the expanding Earth? Anything you want to say there?
Well, I think that, you know, it sounds right to me. You know, and the fact
I have to say it does to me too. That's what's scary.
I mean, I don't see why that's scary. I mean, I think that
because he's a comic book guy, and he's so far ahead of these scientists and, you know, so many other people that, you know, just a source. I scary may not be the right word, but surprising.
Yes, a very surprising source, but But again, considering his intelligence level, yeah. his obvious intelligence level, I think that...
And he loved getting into that. Folks, if you are interested in hearing him talk about that more, you can track down... he actually was being on Coast to Coast. I don't know if he actually ever did that program with Art Bell or not, or I think it's George Noro was the host who replaced him. I'm not sure. I believe it's even a different host now, but he has been on Coast to Coast AM, legendary radio show as well, and talking about that subject. So if you want to, you can look into that a little bit.
But yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a great interview. If you ever have a chance to stop by and chat with him during one of his appearances, I highly recommend it because he's a really interesting guy, and he will absolutely talk your ear off.
Yeah. Okay, Brad, I think that's it. We should probably get out. Bounce here, OUT. Last things?
Wow.
I just want to say...
Please bring the funk.
Bring the funk. Well, I just want to say before going out, it's been a successful week for me. Because I've been another week where I've been polio free, and that's always a positive.
Woo! High point.
Excellent. OUT, folks.
All right. Peace out.